These are my third committee meeting, February 15th, at 3:00 PM in room 405. Considering Senate Bills 88, 122, and 127.
Tony, don't do it.
Do you have to do them all?
No, excellent testimony before my committee on environmental affairs. On auto emissions bill, about a 7-page bill without the bill, Allison. Very good.
What they concluded is a $2.
Let me clarify the bills that we're going to hear today. We did include Senate Bill 101 notice, but we are not hearing that one today. So if any of you are here interested in Senate Bill 100, that's the phosphorus detergent bill, we will not be hearing it today. If you are here for that bill, we will take your name and notify you of the hearing. That was listed in error. Also in the calendar, Senate Bill 123 was listed, but that was a misprint. We intended that it would be Senate Bill 122 and 127, which are related bills. And so the 123 was an error, and we will not be hearing that one today. What we do have are Senate Bills 88, 122, and 127. We have in the room Senator Hoyt and Senator Howitt, who are sponsors of 122 and 127, so I think our first day that we'll hear those two bills first, so each of them can testify and then get on to the other amendments. So, Senator Howitt.
Madam Chairman, I'll leave Senate Bill 122 to Senator Hoyt. Senate Bill 127 was drafted for the committee by the Oregon Pharmaceutical Association, and it was drafted to correct a mistake in what we thought we had done 2 years ago. As Senator DeMent will recall, as a member of the committee, we thought we had passed a bill which allowed the advertising of contraceptives and minimally the counter display. Mr. Speckman and Mr. McClain and the various pharmacists said that during the ensuing period, they were told by the Attorney General, no, we hadn't done that. We hadn't cleaned it up. We hadn't cleared it up, which is unbelievable to me and everybody else. And one of the reasons they claim, the pharmacists claim, why there hasn't been a more active display, merchandising, or whatever you want to call it, campaign. And we said, very well, you go have a bill drafted which will unmistakably bear out the intent of the legislature. So that's all this is. I won't call it housekeeping, I'll call it a ratification of something the House and the Senate of the state of Oregon have voted on. There's no hassle and no fuss on the floor. The only thing I recall on the floor discussion last time was Senator Newbery's concern that advertising, if contraceptives were advertised, would be discreet and tasteful, and of course the language is, as you'll notice, at the bottom line 24, discreet and tasteful. That's all this measure is, then, to do what we said they could do, and it's evidenced by the deletion on line 7 of displayed, evidenced by the deletion in line 21 or 22. I can't for the life of me figure out how we had left those words in. Apparently we did, and yet thought we were doing what we supposed to do, but that's
what this bill is. Tell us about 9:15. I'm sorry. And for 9:15 and 16. That's a good one, didn't it?
I hope we have the right to vote. I'm sure it is, Madam Chairman. Mr. Speckman, he had withdrawn, Madam Chairman, and I just accepted it at face value. the intent of this document. If we've made another mistake, it should not leave this committee without it being rectified, to do just what I said, to allow display and advertising, period, because the more broad approach is embodied in 122, Senator Hoyt will speak to.
Again, this language does do something different. I'm not calling on it, but it does add something else on my system.
I don't know why that was deleted now, John, because that really, I can read too, is sort of the thrust of Senate Bill 122.
Okay, Senator Warner, we will have an expression, I'm sure, we'll have an hearing on the bill.
But this everybody involved once, I think it is safe to say, once.
Once.
That is correct.
Are there any other questions you can just tell?
Thank you.
We have two other persons lined up to testify on 127.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mike McLean, the Secretary of the Board of Pharmacy, and testimony will be relatively short. It was our intent and supposition that in the last session that the display and advertising restriction be removed in the decodification of this section. When it came out, the advertising section was removed, but the display was still curtailed.
As this bill is amended, does it need your approval?
Yes, because the Board of Pharmacy would support this.
Any questions?
And Christian, I just want to say at the last House of Delegates of the Oregon Pharmaceutical Association, we agreed that this bill should be passed and should be amended to some of the discussion, but then we will say, because we figure that that's one way of someone's more distribution, and that would be that they can come in and serve off the display, not off the display, but they can be served by anybody who's working in the store, not just the primary.
I'd like to ask one question. Does this have anything about coin operated machines?
No.
Just the old bearing on that?
At all. It's just that it's in the pharmacy that they can display, and some of them want to display it near the pharmacy department, but it doesn't. It allows them to display any place in the store. But how to delegate to me when they go along with it.
Thank you.
Should know that the committee does not say the language in either of these bills, so that sometimes you might think that a committee introduced a bill that they had kind of worked it out. And in either case, I have done some work on this bill, the prior bill was presented in this section, and the committee in either case examined the language. So although we introduced them, I guess we say the committee can't be held responsible for having accepted an name on the bill. In this matter of contraceptives, I think, in my view, the matter deserves a sermon more than it does legislation, because
Because somehow or another, this topic gets associated with conduct, and we're talking about merchandise. And you can play casino, I guess, do you use the regular deck cards? I've forgotten one about that. But anyhow, it isn't the cards that are fault, if you misuse them. And merchandise, I think, is good in the same way, how it's used, and who uses it, and when to use it. And both these bills have to do with the contraception. And it's important that we keep in mind that we're not trying to legislate morals, but we're trying to legislate health. And that's what these things are concerned with. Now, you folks don't need to be told that, but I think that in discussing this, we need to keep that in mind, so that as people refer to it, for instance, I heard somebody refer to Senate Bill 122 as a slot machine bill or a vending machine bill. Now, if I was touchy, I'd resent that. I know that there's nobody who's been harmed by it. Matter of fact, what that means is that under Senate Bill 122, a merchandiser has several avenues by which he can distribute the merchandise. Senate Bill 122 approaches this matter of the sale of contraceptives and prophylaxis from a merchandising angle and not from a professional angle. It provides that this type of merchandise may be sold by anyone licensed to sell merchandise, that is called a shopkeeper's license. And this part of the bill is, to me, is somewhat technical, since I never owned a shopkeeper's license, but Mr. Fay drafted this, and sometime I think that the committee could have the benefit of her testimony as exactly what this means. I know you know it, Madam Chairman, as a lawyer, and you do, sir, but the rest of you, I think we've got three lawyers, so maybe you don't need to get a majority of
it. Why can finance from my knowledge of a lawyer?
Well, actually, to be a business in Oregon is a legal matter, not a matter of being a good businessman. And the shopkeeper's license is the key to this particular bill. That's the reason I mentioned that. Senate Bill 122 provides that anyone who has a shopkeeper's license may sell contraceptives and prophylactics that do not require a prescription. In other words, if you can sell aspirin, you can sell this type of merchandise too. That's the principle of this bill.
But you know that it used to be unlawful to sell aspirin unless you had a certain license to
say yes, I do that. It still has to be sold through a shopkeeper's license, so I think.
Are you laying under the misapprehension that these articles only sold out by drugs?
Well, it's been so long since I've bought any of them, I don't know where you would go to get them. But
by any selling services.
But not in Oregon, it would be against
what?
The law. It would be against
in
the law,
Oregon?
Yes, sir.
Ah.
Well, sir, you're a lawyer. You can keep out of jail. I couldn't.
How long has it been since you've been out of jail?
Madam Chairman, what the Senator says has really some basis. In many states, these products are sold in service stations or any place else. And there's no restriction whatsoever. Now, there's one real important part of this bill that I know you're going to be having hearings on it again, but I want to call your attention to. Senate Bill 122 has the most important part of all the laws that have to do with this type of merchandise, and that is the quality of the merchandise. And it does say here that the merchandise must be tested as it is under the present law. Oregon is a leader in this area. Our pharmacists have laws that require that they carry first-class merchandise, and they're tested annually, and they're tested by qualified people. I'm told that the Oregon tests are sought after by other states because some of the states don't test this, and they want to know what stuff is being used. In other words, the Oregon testing procedure has a high reputation. And there's no change in this as to the quality of the merchandise. The change is in the method of distribution. Now, Madam Chairman, I'm not really in a position to really put before you the evidence I think is needed to have you fully appreciate the need of this bill. Through no fault of yours or mine, I just knew about this a few hours ago that it was coming before the committee. There are some people that I would like to have you hear from. I will tell you why I introduced this, or had this bill drafted and the committee introduced it. Mrs. Jessely Fosterling from the Planned Parenthood Association is a person who I've been in contact with from time to time in legislation and in other social work. And she told me a year ago, after we passed what we thought was a pretty good bill, and I was real proud of the fact that we passed it, that it didn't do what we thought it did. And I guess that's our fault, because I guess we didn't read it carefully enough. But she said that there were many folks who had needs for merchandise that did not need a prescription, particularly the item of condoms. And that there were lots of stores that didn't sell them to everybody. And there's nothing in the law that says that they shouldn't sell them to everybody. We thought that we were making sure that the merchandise would be displayed so folks would be better educated about the availability and hopefully the benefits of this merchandise. But the fact is that, and I can't prove this because I haven't gone from store to store to find out, but it's commonly stated by all that this merchandise is not available to all people at all times. In other words, it's not out like where you can reach off the counter and get it and say, I want to buy this and pay the cashier. It's kept under the counter. Frequently the salesman or the owner of the store will wonder whether that person should be buying it. And the person that is about to purchase the article is either embarrassed or scared away or certainly knows that that person doesn't want them to buy it. Now you say this is contrary to private enterprise system. All I can say is that the benefits of the private enterprise system were applied to this type of merchandise that did this thing. And I really don't have any new information for you now. What I'd like to have you have is information from people who know, like a place like Portland, as to how available this merchandise is now, whether this is really needed. For instance, I'm not in a position to make a case if somebody were to call this a vending machine bill, which I don't call it. And if somebody were to say that, I'm not sure that I could make a real strong case for that particular type of merchandise. My interest in this is it to be available to everybody that needs it. And that was the reason the bill was drawn as it was. And if you say it's old and permissive, it's certainly different from the bill that you just heard described considerably. If you keep in mind the fact that the merchandise, if needed, should be available, rather than it should be hung up on some professional prejudice or sense of importance, I'm not getting into the right word here, but if it doesn't take a prescription, and it doesn't take a specialist to deliver it, why not make it available to those who want it, when they need it, and where they can find it.
Senator Hoyt, may I clarify my question? But first of all, saying that I agree with the principle you're advocating, really, I'm serious. Now, Companion Bill 127 apparently still retains a prohibition by dispensing to vending. What do you say about that?
Well, Senator, before you came in, Senate Bill 127 was discussed. And the reason it's 127 is before you, the Human Resources Committee introduced a bill that really at the request of its pharmaceutical profession. They agreed with us that the bill we passed last time did not say what we thought it did. And so, since we have this bill, Senator Hallett told them, go ahead and draft a bill that you think does the job that you think is needed. And so in a sense, I haven't read the bill, and I don't think any member of the committee, and I know Senator Hallett hadn't read the bill. It was introduced really at the request of the pharmaceutical profession.
Why shouldn't these things be available, just like cigarettes? Everyone knows that an 8-year-old kid can buy cigarettes any place in Oregon to a vending machine. I don't intend to refute, but they do. But why shouldn't these things be available at all hours to a vending machine?
Senator, that's the reason I introduced I just feel drafted the way I did. I agree with you entirely.
Don't you agree?
Yes, sir. And the Senate Bill 122.
Besides that, it's embarrassing sometimes. Certain people, I suppose, probably of a feminine sex, wouldn't find it.
Interesting enough, it's embarrassing to men.
Let's be practical. Now, I agree wholeheartedly with the necessity of these things. I really am. I can't see any logical argument against any hindrance on this sale. It isn't a question of morals, it's a question of health, is it?
That's right.
So I don't see why they shouldn't be available. Vending machines.
Well, I don't either. Madam Chairman, it's interesting that Senator was mentioning about the embarrassment of women. In talking with druggists, we find that men are more embarrassed about buying them than women. That's not my idea, but I repeat something I heard from a good authority.
I believe in woman's lib, you
know. Well, I'm still not completely clear in my mind, and maybe you have looked at these two bills. Do we really need both of them, or does Senate Bill 127 really do everything that 122 does in a different way? Or?
We should only pass one of them.
Let's put it this way, Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think we probably need just one or the other, not two separate.
Well, that was my feeling, was that maybe we only need one of these two bills, and I wasn't sure which one at this point to do what you wanted to get done, and I agree with what you wanted to get done.
Senate Bill 122 is a more permissive bill than the bill that the funds
it is.
Thank you. No.
Well, they bought their companion measure, right?
No, sir. Ah. The competitive.
Which one do you prefer?
122. Let's just state that Senator Mahoney and I agree that they should be dispensed through vending machines. And the committee, by majority vote, would say no. Then 122 would have to be amended. Or if you might prefer 127. Actually, 127 doesn't do any more than what we thought we did last time. It doesn't do a thing more than what we really thought it did.
Right, but your 127, then, you would expand on what you thought you did last time and go further and allow them to be sold at any place, not only by any more drug stores.
122, though.
122, I'm sorry. Yeah. 122, I'm sorry.
Well, I haven't looked at these before, Senator Hoyt. If 122 passes, the restriction to sale only of pharmacies to remain on the board?
No, sir.
Well, not. There, of course, there is no inhibition in 122 toward the sale of vending machines, is it?
No, sir. Under 122, the way that Mr. Fay explained to me as I asked it,
is there any loophole in there whereby the board could restrict the sale to other than vending machines?
No. The only place where the board comes in is with
the
quality of the product.
Is for the type of.
The quality of the product. And this is very important.
Do you know the origin of the word condom?
No, sir. In fact, when I was away, we didn't pronounce it that way.
Well, named after a man, Englishman, Ontario. I went all through my boyhood and youth and all that without learning that. The other day I read it on the
magazine. Madam Chairman, the interesting aside to what he comments, I was in England this summer and I found that the use of this particular product has had a great upsurge. And in England, there's quite a large public education program on this particular item. We talk about the pill in this country.
Well, I think you ought to be in a vending machine in every schoolyard.
That reminds me of a story, Madam Chairman. During the last session, we had some sex education legislation, and there was questions about what kind of courses they should have, the curriculum, the books to be used and the qualifications of the teachers. And a man who, Senator Mahoney, is well acquainted with, said, I think we ought to take it out of school, the classroom, and put it out in the play yard, the ground where it was, we always had been.
Would you
care
to ask Senator
Hoyt? No.
On the bill?
Madam Chairman, I have one. Okay, Senator Hoyt, in the first, second page of the bill on line
12, 13, and 14, it specifies that you have to identify the product by having the manufacturer and distributor's name, firm, and address on the appliance or container. Now, did you say that the pill could be considered to be the appliance? If so, how are we going to get all that on the pill?
Well, I'm sorry, Senator. The pill is a prescriptive item, and this is merchandise, non-prescriptive material.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't like to ask for favors, but many of us consider this very important legislation. And as the committee works on this, I would like to have a little time to get some people. I know you're going to want some people, but maybe discuss with you who some people, if I don't think of you, might, or vice versa. So that we give this, both these bills a thorough hearing, so that what we do this time, we're not going to have to come back and say, gee, I didn't think that's what it said, or something like that. And it does what we want.
I think we ought to probably schedule the bills for another.
Thank you very much.
My name is Betty Adams, and my address is 2180 Laurel Avenue. And I, as a Salem, Oregon, I, as a parent of two little girls, don't feel like you gentlemen do. And I often wonder why our youth have to put up with what all this permissiveness, because I have had the occasion to speak to a public official, and he said that venereal disease is an all-time high. And it is due to permissiveness, and then you're going to give us some more legislation that we do not need as parents. And if you want to buy those things as adults, you certainly know where to get them. And I feel that our youth in this nation certainly need someone to lead them in a better manner, because really, there's nothing they can do. And I, as a parent, I'd never allow anything of that type that we have allowed so far. And then gonorrhea is one of the highest diseases in the state of Oregon. It even surpasses respiratory disease. And then you tell us that we need some more of the same. And in all sincerity, as a parent of two little girls that have to live in conditions of such, I cannot stand still, and I must speak out, because if this is how you gentlemen feel, I can see now why our nation is in such bad need of some real good leadership, really. And we do not need no pills in the classrooms or either on the playground. If we have to have anything as such, we might as well close the public schools, which a lot of parents are just about sick of it, really. I mean, and we might as well just have our own private schools and have our children taught in a manner that we feel we want them to. Because I am a God-fearing parent, and I feel it is my responsibility to bring up my children as I best know how, because someday when I leave this world, I will have to answer for them. And I know you gentlemen won't have to. So that's all I wish to say.
I appreciate
your May I say I appreciate everything you said. I know you're sincere. And I thank you for the compliment and honor for coming in and especially. I have seven grandchildren. I'll wait from 3 to 16. And I am probably, I'd like to think, one of the foremost in this state, in this legislature, in opposition to this current medical permissive, anything goes. But I think you must understand the purpose of this legislation. I remember reading a book one time about World War I, that was a long time ago. And Lord Allenby, who was in charge of British forces in Cairo, who said I would rather have, speaking of these things, a healthy army than a moral army. Now, this isn't a question of morals. Venereal disease is that leadership. The antibiotics have proven now that dissipating are effective. Venereal disease is increasing in the United States and in Oregon in alarming way.
Can I answer you, Doctor?
Just a minute.
Okay.
In an alarming way. And this isn't a method of combating venereal disease. Now, I've had a little experience in life. I raised a splendid son who was himself a father and a daughter was self a mother. And this is not a case of accelerating or condoning sexual offense. Not at all. It's merely a case of safeguarding health. And you and I may not agree on it. That's the way I look at it. And that is my only interest in it. If by passing this bill, I can save some boy and girl in our high school, or in our colleges, or in any age from contracting a venereal disease, well, then I'll feel that I've done a good thing in helping pass it.
Now, is it my turn?
Yeah.
Okay. And now, the public health official told us that you'll never get venereal disease if you live a one man, one wife, and that you must teach children, if you're going to teach venereal disease, you're going to teach them the consequences of syphilis, and you know yourself, Senator Mahoney, that the consequences of syphilis are that you have either an insane or a blind child, and if you taught your students in this matter, you wouldn't need contraception, because you still do need moral values. I know I have been brought up with, just by my parents, they were just plain God-fearing people, and I've never had any problems with venereal disease or anything else, because your conscience is your guide, and you just can't put all this stuff before you. You have to be guided. At least that's how I've been taught. You don't just put everything so that it would be easy to get at, really. I mean, that's really not a way to even bring up children. It's kind of unnatural, really. But if that's your attitude, that's fine. But I'll tell you, Senator Mahoney, that you'll find a lot of people objecting to your bill. I mean, I, for one, I'm speaking for many people, and we just won't stand for it.
We'll go a little further. Would you suggest that a clinic for the treatment of venereal disease should be wiped out?
Venereal disease would have been wiped out in this country in the 1950s. This public health
official. You haven't answered my question.
But anyway.
Would you abolish clinics for the treatment of venereal disease?
Well, we wouldn't need them.
Would you do it?
Well, I don't think we'd need them if we live right.
You and I are talking and doing this.
Well, I'm not going to say it. See, I'm not that smart in that area. I mean, I don't know just in the venereal area, but I do feel that this gentleman said in the 50s we could have wiped out venereal disease. But with our permissiveness in the 60s, it's an all-time high, and that's all I'm telling you. I'm telling you that's all on record, and if you wish to see it, I could even present it to you.
Any other questions for you guys? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That concludes our hearing on Senate Bill 122, and we will now take up Senate Bill 88. We have a list of the testifying to Jim.
Madam Chairman, at the next hearing, will we have somebody from the pharmaceutical board tell us why they believe contraceptives should only be sold in pharmacies? The difference between these two bills that we just heard, as I understand, is one limits the sale of contraceptives to pharmacies. And I hope somebody will tell us whether the board of pharmacy believes they should be sold only in pharmacies, and if so, why.
Madam Chairman, I'm Ira Jones with the Tax Division of the Department of Justice, representing the Department of Revenue today. Senate Bill 82 was introduced at the request of the Department of Revenue primarily to give us what we think will be better control over cigarettes and cigarette vending machines. As the cigarette tax bill was enacted, ORS 323-210 required the registration of vending machines, and it included, required that there be in a decal or some such matter on the vending machine a memorandum that stated that this vending machine is operated by name of the operator, telephone number, and place of business of the operator, and then a vending machine registration number, and we were to keep track of the registration numbers. Well, this would work fine if we had just a few vending machines around, but there are several operators in the state that have a great number of these, and of course they service them regularly. And they tell me that every few months it's necessary to completely re-repair and re-service the machine. So what they do is in a location, they pull the machine out, replace it with another machine, take it back to the plant, and steam clean it, they go through all the mechanism and everything like that. And in the process, the decal is lost, the registration number is lost, we can't keep track of what number of what machine is out here at X location. And as a result, the registration procedure set forth in 323-210 is very hard and very costly to maintain, and it's not really accomplishing its purpose. The main thing that we want to know is that when we come around to a place where cigarettes are sold by a vending machine, is whom do we contact to get into that machine to inspect its contents to see whether the cigarettes are stamped. Now, if we see that this is by one of these chains that has a lot of machines, the best way we're going to do that is to periodically go out with the person that services these machines and check it right along with the route number. Come on without any notice and check through that way.
Okay, but for the same thing, you get a bag of time
now. Well, but okay, so the one we get is stamped. We don't know about all the rest of the hundreds of packages that are in the machine, and we would like to know about all those other packages as well. So Senate Bill 88 is drawn. It deletes ORS 323-210. It requires that on a machine all it has to be shown is who is the person that regularly places cigarettes in that machine, and the address and the telephone number. That way we can see for the person that has a chain of machines, we can readily recognize the machine. At the same time, we will be able, if it's the person that owns the establishment where the machine is placed, we can immediately go to him and say, well, may we please have a key, we want to inspect the cigarette. And this will then permit the vending machine people, those that do regularly service their machines, to replace them, and they won't bother us at all. We think that we'll probably get as good or better check on the cigarettes in the vending machine than what we presently have. And then you'll notice that in section 3 of the bill, subsection 4 is all new material. One of the things too we found that ORS 323-210 states that if the machine is not properly identified, it can be seized. And so we also made the same provision in section 2, which is to replace that section. But nowhere in the penalty provisions in 323-245 was there any way in which a person could, where a machine was seized primarily for failure to comply with the registration requirement, so here to put the needed information on it, there was no place where the person could very quickly, by either paying a fine or something like this, get his machine back and get it back into operation. So subsection 4 does permit a way in which a person may redeem a seized vending machine by the payment of $25 plus cost of $15, or the actual cost incurred in the seizure proceedings, whichever is greater. This way it's by statute, it does give a person a way to get his machine back with a $25 fine. plus the cost of the TV.
Mr. Jones, I'm you went over this fast enough, and I'm not sure that I understand the whole thing, so let's back up and be sure that I do. The intent of this bill is simply to be sure that they keep this they call intact. Now, they have to have a present time. They're supposed to keep this they call on.
Well, primarily, the purpose of the law is to give the Department of Revenue a means to check in the check on the cigarettes that are in the vending machine. This is our primary purpose. This is the reason for calling for registration of vending machines in the first place.
Well, doesn't the present law require this, though?
Yes, except that these machines get changed, and from the present registration, we have problems of knowing exactly who is responsible for what machine. Plus, it costs a lot to keep re-registering machines all the time. And this bill would make it unnecessary for a person to notify the Department of Revenue every time they're going to move a machine. As long as they just have the required information on the machine, this is fine, and this will comply with the law. And at the same time, because of the information required by Section 2 of the bill, we will know who is responsible for that machine, and we can contact them to inspect the cigarettes in that machine.
How do you keep track of the machines now that this obviously pointed out a problem, but what do you do now?
I'll have to ask Mr. Britt here with the Department of Revenue that administers this part of the law. Maybe he can answer that better.
We try to maintain a file as best as we can, but after working with this over a period of about 4 years, we recognize the fact that it's almost impossible to maintain it. Most of these vending machine owners, they'll put their machine out, and if it doesn't draw well, and they don't sell so much merchandise, they want to move it. And theoretically, they should file with us and talk to the machine. If they do, we can follow the machine around, except we'll never know the last place. We know I can tell you where it's been, but not where it is. And as a result of this, our file just continues to grow. So we have excellent files on all the machines that are located and so on. But whether or not they're current, we can't tell you a thing about it. And administratively, it's almost impossible. And as Ira has pointed out, really our concern is when we go out to look at them, is to check to see whether the cigarettes in the machine are stained. And to find out this backward way, which was implemented in 1966 when the law was passed, has not served its purpose. And we can make it so much easier for the vendors by having them identify the machine, tell us where we can find the key to look at cigarettes in the back. They don't have to bother to notify us, and we're well posted as to where the machines are.
Well, I still am not clear on this thing. Okay, they have a machine out in some grocery store, some tavern, someplace. They move that machine, and you're still not going to know where that machine is, even if it's got a proper decal on it. How do you keep track of where it goes?
We don't. I don't think that we desire to restrict the movement or the placement of a machine. We only want to know if the machine is there. When our agents out in the field periodically go by these places, they always see a vending machine. They'll say, "Well, they check this one." They knew who to contact, and they go look at the merchandise inside. As to where the machine is, or where he collects these, or where he puts these machines, where he locates them, we're really not concerned with. And this is really kind of what we're controlling, as opposed to just being able to look at the cigarettes.
Well, basically, then you go out and examine all the places that might have vending machines, and if you found a vending machine there, you'd want to have a decal on it to identify it. You're not going to keep a file up to date that this particular operator has machines in such and such and such places.
All we want to know is we see a vending machine, and we want to know who do we contact to get the key to look in the back of that machine.
Well, basically, you hit the nail on the head, though. You said when you see a vending machine, I was wondering how you find out where the vending machines were. Apparently, you just travel around looking to places where they would
right,
be and identify them this way, and then you want to know how to get in.
That's correct. Yes.
It's just at random, sir. You know, just out in the field.
Any other questions, Mr. Jones?
Is this a widespread problem?
Well, the fact is that we're maintaining a whole batch of records here that we would like not to have to maintain.
But
it is expensive.
Let's say it is a real problem.
Yes, it is.
Well, it would seem to me, and I'm a particular objector to the emergency corps, I think jobs create a new job in this. It seemed to me you should have the emergency fund.
Perhaps we should. There's always a question when you get into these tax measures or measures that come close to taxation.
You call
is,
it
this, is this a major affecting taxation? I personally don't think so.
It's not a revenue raising.
But I don't think that we would have no objection to placing the emergency fund.
If it's not a major revenue measure, it wouldn't be in the tax.
Well, it's not a
raising
revenue.
It's not a raising of money,
that's
no.
I don't care, I just give you that freedom money.
Well, even if this were to pass, whether you put the emergency clause on it or not, we are going to have some time to get the word out to the people and everything anyway.
How long will that take? You mean they're going to have to get the word out to them, they have to do what they should do?
Yes, By how long do you think it'll take to get there?
How long period of time do you have that? I would say that you could do this for maybe a 60 or 90 day period.
I don't care. That's you.
There's a problem.
Well, that's right. And this is another reason for not putting the emergency clause on this record.
How long would it take you folks to comply with that?
The problem is there's two different kinds of vending operations. There's the kind that Mr. Jones referred to, the company who owns a number of machines. That's no problem. They know, we all know who they are, and that's no problem. The problem lies in the individually owned vending machines. The gas station at the corner crossroads that has its own vending machine, or lots of operations of this type have individually owned machines. Therein lies the problem. We're going to have the testifying. So if there's any other questions, Jones, or Pat, Cameron, or any other questions. Any other questions? Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I represent
the Oregon Automatic Vendors Association. This is a trade association of the companies who have as their primary business the operation of a large number of various kinds of vending machines, cigarette and other types. I might say very briefly, Madam Chairman, that we support the concept of Senate Bill 88 and the bill itself as drafted. The original provision that required the machines not only be identified by owner but also be numbered sequentially was put into the original bill. It was enacted by the 1965 session. And like any new concept, new bill, we found a few bugs in the original proposal. And one of them is the fact that it's just almost impossible for us to keep the Department of Revenue informed as to what number decal is where, because we do bring the machines into the shop on a periodic basis, steam everything off, the decal and everything. We have to put a new decal on with a new number and then inform them that the old one has been destroyed, the new one has been put on, and it's a complicated mess and the machines are moved around. We're convinced, as I'm sure the Department of Revenue is, that there is no public benefit served by trying to keep these things numbered in any kind of a sequence. So we would support the simplification of this part of the code. It would certainly make it easier for us. We certainly make it easier for the Department of Revenue, and I don't think there's any public danger created by not having each decal numbered. So that's the reason for it. And also, we think it will more likely result in these individual machines that I mentioned a moment ago in response to Senator Mahoney's question, getting a decal on them and complying. We comply because we have so many machines, but the person who owns his own machine, the one machine, he's not very familiar with the whole cigarette tax law and the portion to deal with sales of vending machines.
The question is,
thank you, Madam Chairman.
Anybody else here who wants to touch on Senate Bill 88? Well, we only have those three lined up for today, so that concludes our hearing, and we will have a work session on Senate Bill 15 on Wednesday. I'll be right here in this room. This is the Senate Consumer Affairs Committee. We, in room 405 of the Capitol Building, February 17, 1971, to discuss Senate Bill 60.
I find that most of these agencies in sitting in judgment and on quasi-judicial authority are totally incompetent to preside over such matters. In other words, they do not have the background or the training in law. And as a result of that, the majority of their decisions, when contested, are reversed. And I feel, strongly feel, that if we are going to regulate commerce and regulate it in this state without discrimination, equally, that all commerce should be subjected to this bill with prosecution by the Attorney General. Now, I have had this experience in the past, and it goes back clean into the time of Governor Mark Hatfield. If you will recall in the 54 hearings on the subject of insurance, the legislative findings of fact at those hearings held that the insurance industry had not been regulated during the terms of several commissioners back. And I have personal knowledge and evidence, personal knowledge and evidence to the effect that it is not regulated today. We have the laws, but they are not being enforced. And for that reason, I believe it was Robert Wyatt Thornton, who published in the Salem Statesman in response to a letter that I had written to the editor. He stated as Attorney General that he did not have the authority to act against insurers for fraudulent misrepresentation, that that authority had to come from the governor. And I would assume that if he is correct in that statement, that our present Attorney General would also not have the authority to act against the fraudulent misrepresentations of the life insurance industry. Now, this bill, as a statute, would give the Attorney General the authority that he needed to act against fraud, regardless of what industry or where it came from. Now, I find nothing in this bill that would not be applicable to the business of insurance, even to the extent of Section 5, where it is intended, due consideration shall be given to the interpretation of the Federal Trade Commission and the federal court. Now, of course, our insurance industry is a creature of the federal government, in that through the Act of March 9, 1945, the state was given the right to regulate the business of insurance. However, there were several exclusions to that act. The Sherman Act, as to coercion, intimidation, and boycott, were not affected by the Act of March 9, 1945. Also, the Act specifically stated that the right to regulate the industry did not extend to any scheme to accomplish the forbidden result, nor did it extend to any purpose or reason that was not of legitimate interest to the state. Now, in my opinion, this bill would only be acceptable to me if it applied to all of industry without exception. And I find that if there were exceptions and exclusions, that it would be a discriminatory application of the law, because the insurance division has not yet advocated that they adopt all federal consumer legislation. Now, we have had numerous federal consumer legislation, Truth in Lending, things of this nature, that should be applicable to the business of insurance in this state, but have never been applied. Now, this bill would bring those provisions under all of this industry, and yet here we have the insurance industry sitting out here, and they're only subject to our insurance code, which I find to be to actually have the ultimate effect of a monopoly, because there is absolutely no competition in the business of insurance. And I feel that this bill, if it were adopted to the insurance industry, would eliminate that position. Now, this isn't my own personal opinion. I'm sure that most of you realize that there have been at least 20 books written by knowledgeable authors, implying that the insurance industry is the biggest legalized racket in America today. And I feel that I can prove that. And for that reason, I think that if the people who are sponsoring this bill, if they can't advocate that it also applies to the business of insurance, then I would like to personally know their reasons why not.
May I ask you, Madam Chairman, what business are you in, sir?
I'm in the insurance business. I sell life insurance. But I would very much like to be proud of having that license. And I can't be proud of it until this industry is regulated in accordance to the law. And I feel that if this state doesn't soon regulate it, they're going to lose that right. Because you have to assume that Congress granted the right to regulate the business, and it follows that any time that there is a right to regulate, there is a corresponding right to enforce it.
I'd like to ask Mr. Wright one question. You apparently are unhappy with the way the present laws that govern the insurance business are being handled. Now, what makes you think that this law here would be administered enough better to correct the problem? Do you want to put your finger on what's the problem with the present situation?
Well, it's right on the front page. This brings this under the Attorney General's and the District Attorney's office. Right now, under your insurance code, there is too much discretionary authority granted to the insurance commission. Entirely too much. Under the present law, if it were enacted in accordance to the law, felonies that are considered crimes that normally would be prosecuted by the Attorney General's office are attempted to be prosecuted by the insurance department. Now, he has a great deal, or at least he feels he has, a great deal of discretion along these lines. As a result of the 1964 hearings on insurance, a certain type of policy was completely outlawed in this state. Now, there is evidence right here in the Salem courthouse to the effect that insurance companies have violated that provision. They have been selling profit-sharing policy in this state after the enactment of that law. But it still remains a fact, gentlemen, that never in the history of this state has this state ever taken action against any insurance company for the violation of the insurance code. Now, why? Is it because they're perfect little angels? No, that's not the question. The 64 hearings showed that they weren't. The 64 hearings showed that the industry was misrepresenting their product to the public, and that the industry had not been regulated during the terms of several commissioners back, and our present commissioner has not made any changes in that attitude. Now, why should I, as a layman, have to proceed in the circuit court, issuing writs of mandamus against the director of commerce and the insurance commissioner, as well as the governor himself, trying to force a duty to regulate the insurance department? Right now, I have three court actions against the state for malicious prosecution. I have an action before a three-judge federal court that will be argued this Tuesday. And in that court, I'm challenging numerous of the insurance laws of the state of Oregon as being misrepresentations themselves. I have alleged that they're nothing more than sales aids for con artists to continue to fleece the public. And all of this in this bill here, House Bill 50, as to misleading words, statements, or phrases would be applicable. Now, we have them in the unfair trade practice section of the insurance code, but they're not enforced. And I can give you a very vivid illustration. What is an insurance policy dividend? Most people don't know. They feel that it's the same as a share in a stock. But there is a difference. And if you care to look it up in words and phrases, you'll find at least 10 pages in there defining the word dividend. the general, ordinary meaning of the word. It's an earning. It's a profit. Something is the result of an investment. Now, you also find in Words and Phrases the meaning of the word insurance policy dividend. And one thing that stands out there, gentlemen, is that an insurance policy dividend is, in fact, not a dividend at all. The word is a total and complete misnomer. So why is the industry using it, when it is against the law to use words, statements, and phrases that are misleading? The question is it misleading or not? It is the misrepresentation of this one word that brought on about the hearings in 1954 and caused the outlawing of the profit-sharing concept. But they didn't eliminate the source of the misrepresentation. There is no reason for the industry to use this word, because there is absolutely nothing in an insurance policy that could be righteously called a dividend. Your federal definition is that it is not a true dividend.
And Tim, how would you far afield from the bill?
Yes, my question was answered several minutes ago.
Two forms. First of all, I have the amendment in amendment form. Second of all, I have them in cut and paste form. So I think it's easy to follow the cut and paste form. I wonder if Dave and Mr. O'Leary could join. Let me, if I might, make a preliminary statement about these amendments, and then I propose to go. I think I'll leave the sheet mark because I don't think I may want to listen to it. First, the preliminary statement, and then let Mr. O'Leary make the preliminary statement, and then I propose to go through the amendments as a group and then come back to them one at a time for whatever consideration you want to give them. First of all, just by way of preliminary statement, I met with Mr. O'Leary, also the attorney for Sears, Mr. Ayers, and with Bernard. Dave Shannon and myself, we met for about 3+ hours yesterday. We met for another hour, and I left and probably some more time after that. These are an attempt on my part to meet, insofar as I think possible and appropriate, the objections raised by Mr. O'Leary in the testimony before the committee. These are not presented as joint amendments on his behalf and on my behalf, and he reserves the right to oppose the bill, but I think he will advise you that he thinks these amendments go a long way to the position that he represents. I wonder if you might want to make a general statement, and I'll go through the amendments.
I would appreciate it in a demonstration. Let me pass out to Senator Wilmer has copies of these, and pardon quality of copies. These are the amendments that were made to Senator Wilmer. I think the document will come out just right. These are the ones that were made to Senator Wilmer for SB50. I have here the copies of the amendments with comments, which are, for the most part, substantively similar, were the provisions of parallel for HB 1088. We, as Senator mentioned, we did meet
while we don't see eye to eye on each provision, I feel that he has either specifically or substantively met the bulk of our objections, and his amendments will yield what honestly has to be termed a generally balanced piece of legislation, balancing the interests of consumers and users and business. I think our major reservation relates to the class action provision. We realize that there are arguments in favor of class action that won't burden you with the dissipation of class action because it will act on it. In the SB50 amendment, which is a thermofax copy that we gave to Senator Wilmer, we started with a suggestion that these class action provisions be deleted, which is our basically unalterable provision. However, we did submit along with that our suggestions of class action management and protection provision, which attached to the back of the first three pages of numbered amendments. These are our opinion of what class action should contain. Senator Wilmer and Dave Shannon worked quite hard and worked out some alternative suggestions that they'll be suggesting to you, which do offer some reasonable protections. We would prefer to see some of the language, more of the language from ours than in there, but we think that they've done a generally honest and balanced job. Actually met substance of many of our objections, with the exception of our basic premise in regard to class action that we oppose. But yeah, as you go through them, and you feel free compared to the comments I made last week, that he reaches substantively to the bulk of our amendments, and that on a balanced bill, we feel that. We also feel that the Attorney General's Bill HB 1088, with the amendments that we submitted to it, is a bill that we would support that doesn't have the class action provision, and it does have the creation of the Consumer Protection Division in that bill, which we favor that division. No further comments.
Now I'm supposed to go for something else, and yes, I'm supposed to go through the amendments, explain them as we go along, and suggest that the simple thing might be just take 5 minutes to go through all of them and then come back to them one at a time. And it's 5 minutes, I kind of summarize the whole pattern of that. Or you refer to them just one at a time.
All right.
And then and I said you have in front of you amendments in proper form that will accomplish these things. All right, the first one I think is essentially not controversial. It just says that the district court, a small claims court, a justice court, may also be a court which these matters may be heard. This is particularly important in connection with the private lawsuits that might be filed under this bill. I don't know if that's controversial.
I think it's a good thing.
Then, did you want to act on these or what?
No, I don't think we can act on these separately. But some of these proposals that Mr. Larry is, we go if they're on a page and have any comment, if they're on a page.
Surely. I will make comments with the amendments where appropriate. It won't be doing anything.
We have one proposal on this page that is very
aligned. Yes.
Also
right.
Now, the next thing on page 3, the next amendment you'll find is line 5. Mr. O'Leary suggests taking out the words unfair message of competition and we've taken those words out. This makes it I think rightly pointed out that this is not a bill to protect other businesses, it's a bill to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
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 No one. The
next one on line 19, I think, again, Mr. O'Leary suggested just some clarifying language. I think it's clearer that if they are not, rather than listing the alternative, that I think is almost that better style, really. They're going to give their original new if they are not. It's kind of more all inclusive than saying if they are deteriorated, all the reconditioned repair and use their second hand. I think that's the stylistic thing.
What is the word new again? I think it's redundant.
I had to read it twice before I knew what it meant. The way it is. Well,
I got it.
If they're not original or new, I suppose you'd have to say it's going to be. Not original or new, then. Except the style. Oh, all right. The next one, here again, I think this is another suggestion where line 30, where we had said, unless the advertisement discloses the limitation of quantity, and a suggestion was made just stopping at the disclosure of limitation, in which case the language is more inclusive. And here I think Mr. O'Leary suggests something which makes it fairer.
A question here, what other things besides quantity come into this?
It would generally be quantity, I think, that what with concept of ingenuity that people fear in the marketplace, the person who could have a disclosure of a false limitation of quantity, which arguably wouldn't violate the statute.
Okay. Then on page 4, the pacing, we get down to the first two matters of some substance. If you recall, the first, I think, major point that Mr. O'Leary made in connection with this list of deceptive practices was that he didn't want a businessman to be innocently committing a deceptive practice. And we have written the language in number 3, patient, here, which says, it shall be a defense to an action brought under section 3 of this act that the seller neither had knowledge nor with the exercise of reasonable care would have known that he's engaging in acts prohibited by this section. This language is roughly parallel to the language in the existing Oregon law, which has been there since 1967. Let me talk about the other ones because they relate. Also, Mr. O'Leary objected particularly to items P and Q. If you look at them on lines 11 through 14 of page 4, because they were, he felt more difficult for a businessman to easily determine what was lawful and what was unlawful. In other words, they're kind of catch-alls. Like P is engaging in any other conduct which similarly creates a likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding, and Q is engaging in any act or practice which is unfair or deceptive to the consumer. So, attempting to meet his objection, we've put in a new number 4. Sub 4, no action shall be brought under subsection P and Q or subsection 1 of section 3 unless the Attorney General has first established a rule or regulation under section 5 of this act declaring the practice to be unfair or deceptive to the consumer. Then I think we better cross-reference to the top of page 5 and consider that widget where we have given the Attorney General power to make rules or regulations technical. But the new language in accordance with the procedures of ORS chapter 183. So essentially what that means put together is that the Attorney General may, if he would, suggest
rules or regulations defining P&Q. And they are subject to all the procedural safeguards in Chapter 183, which is hearing, notice, and the possibility of a court declaratory judgment if the result is illegal. So by adding 4 along with this language on the top of page 5, you make it specific what the P&Q is with a due process procedure for getting there. And yet you allow the Attorney General to define practices which otherwise would be weaved around the other language. I think that's what I want to say about those 3 in the package.
On this point, I'd just quickly say that we still object to the P&Q objection is on the by clause. However, the subsection 4 and interrelation to section 5.2 modify the substance of our objection and lead you toward the substance of our objection on the omnibus clauses and certainly mitigate the problem.
John, if you read both those sections, how much are you reading?
Can I yield to Dave on that? Dave's the guy who knows important as my other person. So I can give you some examples of situations where people are ingenious enough to get around the situation. One of the questions that's come up, particularly in the field of franchising, which we do not now have any regulation on, but is the sale of a product where you make an investment up to $5,000, $10,000, is income expectation. We don't have anything about that. If a guy says, if you make $11,000 in 5 days, he's talking about a future fact. Now, if I have some kind of relationship to past action, I'm befuddled how I'm going to catch that one under a present act. And this kind of thing would give an opportunity. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has brought actions against companies doing this kind of thing under the general section, which is unfair and deceptive practice. And now we have decisions on their part, or proposed rules under their FCC suggesting that this is unfair and deceptive, that it's a misrepresentation of income expectation. I would consider this as an example that might come under here where the Attorney General would hold a hearing on this, giving people notice, and then present the question as to what kind of restrictions there are in this field. And as I said, I don't think we can cover it right now.
Yes, I was wondering, I'm a little bit in the dark as to just exactly how much the Attorney General is going to be allowed to do. We're not giving him carte blanche to go ahead and write to, you know, substantive changes in this thing. With this, he has to relate them all back to what we have already spelled out. Is that the protection there?
I would read as the number two. It would have to relate to the A through O, since it talks about similarly. I think number two is broader, but number two would still have to meet the test of being unfair or deceptive and be subject to, first of all, the hearing procedure, and second of all, the declaratory judgment procedure of a court assessing it.
The proposed legislation from the Federal Trade Commission has this section in it, and it's the kind of language that would relate very, I would say, very closely back to the Federal Trade Commission proceedings.
You might look at the section 5, sub 1 at the bottom of that page, and on the top of the next page, suggesting FTC interpretations as being a relevant guide.
Included. I'm not
I don't see a point going through the amendments that I submitted for negotiation with Senator Wilmer.
Okay, any other questions?
The next one on page 5, line 13, is just eliminating the redundancy. This one law covers that. That's the order and adjustment covered in that line. Then on line 22, now here we have a policy difference. We had originally to get at the present Oregon law does not have. I'm sorry, did I miss one?
Yes.
Forgive me. Underneath the I don't think it's controversial, but on page 4, line 24, adding the words or regulation.
Also,
There again, I think that is a redundancy, and again, this is in line with here, it's a consumer bill, not a bill to protect competitors. Forgive me for that. I think the next one is substance is line 22, page 5. Our present law does not provide that the prosecuting attorney give any advance warning to the person that he is proceeding with at all. We have proposed in this bill advance notice of 7 days for service of investigative demand. And 7 days for notifying the person of the alleged excessive trade practice and release to be sought. In this situation, it's fair, for example, to a person who, a large company that may have only a branch office on the ground and may wish to communicate with the home office. But that's an additional protection that's not provided by present law. We have said 7. Prentice and his proposal said 30. We suggest 10.
Are you happy?
It's a matter of preference and convenience as opposed to dire need.
It was our feeling of 10 days. The question is how much time it takes for the branch office to notify the home office, and some of them are fairly bureaucratic, but it was our feeling that if they were told that Dave Shannon is, or a program is after them, within 10 days they could prepare their views on the matter, we thought.
John,
yes. Next paragraph. The notwithstanding provision.
Then
the next one is on section 9 on page 6, where now notice section 9 deals only with orders once the practice has been declared to be unlawful. In other words, here we're getting to the remedy after the adjudication has been made. And we suggest the appointment of a receiver or the revocation of a license as a technique of restoring the money to persons who were victimized after the court made the finding. You notice, after the practice could have been unlawful. We agree with benefits of the revocation of a license is too extreme a remedy, and we have limited the appointment of a receiver in those situations to the situations where there's an urgent need to move. and this is fairly similar to the normal circumstances which a receiver is appointed under present law. And this again, I hope meets the objection that he was concerned with.
I think he's very good.
Then on section 11, now we get to the problem of class action. And let me emphasize that the tenor of O'Leary and his client's position is that they're opposed to class action. Without waiving or diminishing his opposition to class action, he has suggested to us some ways of making it more palatable if we insist on having class action. We have carefully gone over the language that he has proposed, and since his language was a little longer, this is based primarily on a combination of Massachusetts and California class action statutes, which are existing law in other states. Now, let me just outline basically what we're talking about. His first concern, and a very major concern that's expressed the other day, was that he had no real objection to the $200 as being minimum damages if one individual sued. That's in section 11, paragraph 1, line 6. But he thought it would be grossly unfair if there was a class action, and the class prevailed, and the $200 minimum damages provided for the entire class. We accept that and have written in the words actual damages, which appears on line 14. Alright, then this long insert essentially defines a procedure. Now, the first part of the procedure is essentially giving advance warning to the company that's about to be sued, stating what the complaint is, and giving the company 30 days to meet it. Think of this in terms of a situation where maybe a branch office of a company, a branch manager, has done something he shouldn't have done. We'll use an example in our conversation, but maybe a bad day for quick operation. And when it's brought to the attention of the home office, they say, that's wrong. We're firing the branch manager. That still doesn't provide remedy for the aggrieved consumer. But it's a good example of the kind of situation where a responsible company in that situation should have the opportunity of meeting the problem in a correct way before they're faced with a lawsuit. That's essentially what we're getting at in this 30 days warning to them, during which time they've got a right to take restitutionary action if they wish. Then also as part of that, and if their restitutionary action is offered and it's not accepted by the plaintiff, and if a lawsuit is filed, and the plaintiff does not get any more than was tendered, the plaintiff cannot pyramid cost and attorney's fees. That's the second.
On that point, though, if
you do
the first $10
or after damages, the greater. In the first paragraph, the second paragraph, the class action paragraph.
That's the individual amount, but in the class action, you can still get that, right?
No. Class action only actual damages.
Oh,
if one person sues, he can get the $200 and they don't worry. That's not their concern. Their concern is the moldable plaintiff problem. All right, so that's the first thing that the...
Let me get a question on this. Couldn't you evade the class action thing and make it more profitable for, say you had 100 people here and each one sued separately, as long as they can get $200 plus their attorney's cost, the first guy sued they can do it, then they end up possibly costing the same thing as a class action, and actually they have to go through the motions, of course.
Don't we have to manage the court or attorney's fee lobby?
Yes, that would be
an individual case.
What is that? That would be question four. And maybe.
I think part of the problem is being avoided by the fact that if someone went out in that type of situation, you have to include his client.
Yeah, it's not a suit. I can see it as a suit to this lawyer saying, oh boy, I've really got something. I've won this case, and now boy, there must be thousands more of the same thing.
Don't except if it gets in the newspaper. The report of the
first one.
Of the first one.
My case.
Yeah.
Don't we have contingency liabilities on section one? So,
yes, we do.
And was that not
section four? I don't see it stated in the attorney's fees are provided in section seven, the new amended section seven.
So we have covered.
And it says.
It's not pasted in here.
No, it's not.
For some reason.
I don't know what.
For some reason, we do not have a pasted on section seven. And we.
Yes, but that could be struck.
Will you read the language, David, and some word goes? We do have some material that covers, but I don't think that's what you're getting at. This is in your amendment, but not
in this is section 7. And it was, in any action brought by a person under this section, a court may addition to relief provided in this section, award a reasonable attorney's fees and costs if the following conditions are met. One, notice is given to the alleged violator of this act 10 days prior to the commencement of the action of this section. Such notice shall contain the alleged violation, the amount of damages sustained, the demand for damages be paid or the transaction be rescinded. B, the defendant refused the plaintiff's demand and did not respond within 10 days of receipt of notice. C, that if the alleged violation of this act, if the alleged violator of this act tenders an offer prior to the commencement of this action and the person bringing the action refuses the offer, that the person bringing the action must be awarded greater damages than the offer tendered.
I think it's in front of you in the printed amendment. Now, let me just describe what that, Jay, what page is it on in the amendment?
Next to the last page
of the printed amendment. Page.
We don't have
that's good.
No, you have that.
No,
you each have one of my amendments.
I thought you had.
Sure.
Doesn't look like yours.
Here, let's try these. Here it is.
This is page.
Oh, now I've got it.
Here it is.
Here, right. Page 5 of the printed amendment. For some reason, we don't have these pasted in. Let me just describe what these do. At the present time, Hector, in Oregon, at the present time in Oregon law, may I go ahead and tell you?
Yeah.
Present time in Oregon law, there are two situations that come readily to mind where a plaintiff can get attorney's fees in addition to his actual damages. One is a suit for property damage in a tort case or damage case under $1,000. And the other is a suit on an insurance policy, suing your own insurance company. In both those situations, they have analogous provisions where you must make advance demands and be rejected. And only then are attorneys to suffer. So this is like, actually, this language is something that David and I dreamed up in our concern for. Members of retail trade here, they were seeing benefits in time.
We take the
deprivation. I'm sorry,
too. Well, fine.
But I think y'all will get it.
Looks like you've taken care of it.
I think. But anyway, let me go back to the classroom. The first thing was the opportunity of doing right before the suit is filed. That covers all of number three. All right, then number four deals with a preliminary hearing. Now, the conditions here are conditions that the court must find before the suit can go forward. In other words, before the defendant company is put to the burden of defending on the merits against all of the claims fraud. This is a preliminary hearing which establishes if it's appropriate for a class action to go forward. And so the court must find, if you look on the second page, that the class that was under suit is more appropriate than the individual action. The members of the class are Oregon residents, or the alleged wrongful acts occurred in the state of Oregon. That's to make sure that somebody doesn't file suit in court in Lynn County and on behalf of all residents of Alaska, Idaho, North Carolina, and Lynn County. Three, questions of law or fact common to the class are substantially similar and predominant over questions affecting individual members. That's again just a way of saying it's just a true class action. You know, we do have an identity of interest, really. Number four, the class can be reasonably identified and limited so as not to make the class unmanageable, no damages indefinite. Premise is rightfully worried about a kind of consistent file in California with one file on behalf of all citizens of the United States.
All citizens of the state of California.
This would allow a court to rule out that kind of a. Then five, provision for notice to the members of the class. And this is important because the members of the class are bound by it. You see, they must have notice. Then at the next page, number C, this is taking the language of the so-called defense of mistake, the same language we had previously, section 3, and saying that the businessman can, if he proves it's a mistake, that he's got a defense. And the important part of C is that it allows him to establish that in a preliminary hearing before he has to go through the whole long hearing and the ultimate case. In other words, he can establish the sort of bona fide error that's set forth here, that's the end of it, right there. And other things set forth here. And then five provides that the court retains control of the class. This is important because the charge is sometimes made that when class suits are filed, that the original class is often charged minority stockholders. Where the minority stockholder is in the business of filing these kinds of suits and seeks to get bought off in something that's a benefit to him rather than benefit to the class as a whole. So once the suit is filed, the whole thing is under the control of the court, and the court can ensure equity. Now, this, Valley wanted to be heard on this, but this goes to the substance of his concerns about class action, remembering he's opposed to them,
right?
And is based largely on Massachusetts and California existing law. I think you may want to comment on that.
My comment comes down to, as indicated in our suggested amendment here, we are opposed to class actions for the reasons I set forth last week. The attachment includes the same theory of the numerous of the protection senators and senators. Not all of them exactly the same way we put forth theories probably first and some different words in the beginning on all of them. A number of the technical protection management questions that we raised, but we still feel that class actions inappropriate in this remedy in class
action.
This is a technical comment. I would think that in your speech, on 4C, which is on page 3, is that your preliminary hearing should go to the acceptability of the restitutionary cure tendered by the alleged violator prior to the suit without getting into the merits necessarily. Now, this was the interview derived from Massachusetts and California, and I think it's back on page 1 and 3, but primarily from Massachusetts. And California noticed the man's restitutionary cure opportunity section. It's clear, provides more definite standards and would affect a more efficient recovery for consumers than does the Massachusetts style adapted by the Senator.
At that point,
if you comply with those things, the court can in an action, it then puts it on the plaintiff. If he feels that you have not complied with it, he can go ahead and proceed with his lawsuit for damages. And it was very important to think that they're facing that case, but no class action means any damages, or however, you can do an action for injunctive relief alone. I'd also like to point out that there's a class action bill that we oppose in California like this. At that point, substantially conforming to the original one. At that point, there's a provision in there that any attempt to comply with the restitutionary, to make a restitutionary offer by the alleged violator is not an out-of-court admission, and is not an inadmissible in evidence as an offer to compromise in California evidence code, except for purposes during bona fide in connection with the bona fide defense section in the California Act. The plaintiff is then at the risk of it must make the decision as to whether the restitutionary suit is proper or not. You can then file a suit or not file it depending upon the determination. If he is wrong and he files the suit, the fact that the alleged violator has performed an appropriate restitutionary hearing in the court to the defense, or would be in the nature of the defense since it would be cut off the judge or class action. As the substance of California.
It seems to me that this has come out of the Supreme Court
I tend to agree with you because I feel that the part in here about that the alleged violations were not intentional and result from bona fide error, notwithstanding the reasonable procedure to ask the board such error, Kemp raises questions of fact relating to the case opposed to the merit of the restitutionary offer.
Okay, do any objection to Parsons C at all?
I don't have any objection. I would see this as a first step is that the company has made a settlement offer which has been rejected by the class plaintiff. Then he comes into court at the preliminary hearing and would like to reassert that settlement offer primarily based on his belief that any act that did occur was unintentional on his part. And so he's trying to force the plaintiff's class to accept the settlement partly based on they've already rejected it. They've accepted in the first place, you never get to this stage. But because he's already given them notice. Now you're in court, and he's trying to say that was a reasonable settlement offer primarily because I had no knowledge of what was going on. I don't see how he's injured because he's not making an admission. Well, he's supposing.
Well, I have no objection to the fact he's pleading
guilty
and just stating that that the defense that it's just picking up the entire language from previously, it shall be a defense that the alleged violations were not intentional or going on prior.
Well, I think that when you have that prior language, it's the defense that the point here is to encourage either an intentional or non-intentional violator of the act to perform without going through the process of litigation, without going through the long drawn out battle. So you have to have something at the other end, something that will encourage the defendant to make an offer and cause the plaintiff to seriously consider it other than the attorney's fee section.
in the nature of what you have in fee, but without going to merit. This is why the California provision, when I was talking days earlier, I said that in this type of thing, you must prefer the California thing. This is one of the reasons, because it has that type of built-in mechanism in it that would offer greater protection. However, I would again reiterate that my comments are suggested as technical, because we, again, are opposed to class action.
My suggestion, maybe we might go ahead and meanwhile try to have in mind that does this.
I think you understand what we're doing on class action, and the next thing is we've read you the provision of number 7 on attorney fees, which you have on the print, on the amendments that are not paid today.
Three should be crossed out and 6 included. It's also part of your amendment.
Line
15.
The question we had said, just the next thing down is line 28 of page 7. We had said action drawing the section shall be commenced in 1 year from discovery of the unlawful method act of practice. I think this is a mistake, because that discovery might be 25 years hence. And so the problem is to get some kind of limitation on that. We have suggested 2 years from the discovery. I said 2 because that's our normal tort statute in Oregon. 2 years from discovery, and then we've added the language suggested by and it's all from the time when a reasonable man should have discovered the unlawful method act of practice, which puts some terminal point on it. Prentice favored the continuation of the 1 year provision. I suggested 2 because that's the normal statute in other sort of actions. Then the next one is on page 8, the top of the page, we're indebted to Prentice. We're again aiding consumers on this one, where unless we added the word action brought by the absentee, we're allowing the holder in due course to have be in a better position than the seller. What this is about is Oregon the tort statute 2 years, the contract statute is 6 years. And this means that at any time that the seller sues the buyer after the 2 year period, before the 6 year period, the buyer may assert any rights that he otherwise would have.
I got a question.
All right, the next one appears on page 8, line 21. This goes to one of Prentice's suggestions, which I had hoped was implicit, but this makes it explicit. The problem, this whole section deals with the so-called investigative demand, where the prosecuting attorney is requiring the company to produce documents and other testimony. It's similar to a deposition in a civil case. The question arises, suppose the material that is thought to be reached is a trade secret, or is a confidential material in some way which might be of use to competitors, and the company wants to say that they will not disclose that information. They've got a right to present that to the court before the court can produce anything, and the court can decide
whether they should be required to produce it or not. And the court has a variety of normal techniques for deciding what to do. Sometimes the court itself looks at it before it shows it to the other side, and there's many techniques, but I think that's what that one's about.
Okay. All right, then page 9, the top line, kind of suggested to such services, circuit court may direct and move personal services in the state, I think primarily because it's awful vague, and if you leave that out, you just have your... If you leave it out, you have the normal techniques for substitute service. But if you add that, you let the circuit court say, well, I decide that it can write them a letter, and that makes you let you... If you put that four and leave 1, 2, and 3, you're essentially leaving the present law. We agree on section 14B, commencing on line 11, that revoking the charter to do business is too extreme a remedy for failure to comply with investigative demand. The proper method is the normal contempt power of the court. Okay, which is left in. The person doesn't produce what he's supposed to produce. The court can hold him in contempt like he can in any other proceeding. Yeah. Then on the next page, section 16. Here again, Dave and I thought this was implicit, but we're making it explicit by adding on line 4 and also line 11 the word willfully. Now this refers to here a person is either an injunction against them in one, or they have agreed voluntarily to an agreement not to do something, and they violate the injunction or violate the assurance they've given. And we agree that before the fairly major penalties are invoked, that violation must be willful. As I said, they break the court order, the court is going to book that if they go willful. I think the 4 on line 19 is technical.
At this point, somebody in there, I'll tell you. I would like to suggest an amendment at this time, which on this production is number 21 on the 30 page. The exact return hold back. The 3rd page. It's a one paragraph page. The thermal facts is stapled together. Two enclosures. If you'll get to the start, the first 3 pages is the first enclosure, and then the secondary enclosure. Okay, number 21. And this is an amendment that is some model less than TX. And I understand and been told by numerous people that this is against the tradition that exists in the state of Oregon. And contrary to what the Attorneys Association believes, but it is our suggested language that the Attorney General primarily have prior approval of this transaction, and that in conjunction with the provisions of 1088, as I indicated back originally, we very much in favor of the Consumer Protection Division in the Attorney General's office, and in that connection, we feel that centralized coverage and enforcement of deceptive trade practice is essential in order to provide a realistic turn of effect towards yard with decentralized enforcement, you have, let's say if you have a violation by fly-by-night operator up in the northeast corner of Oregon, just determine, hears about it and starts investigating, the guy goes down the southeast corner of Oregon and you move around from county to county, from district to district to county. Yet if you have centralized enforcement, when the act is submitted up in northeast Oregon, it comes to the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division and you can reach out when the person is now in southeast Oregon. So that you really have effective enforcement, effective public enforcement. It just seems to me that you have to have the centralized power of the Attorney General's office. And therefore, either our amendment or 21.
This is one that I think would not be realistic in Oregon. Not only have the district attorneys traditionally been very jealous of their right to proceed in all matters that might be in their jurisdiction without the prior approval of the Attorney General, but typically the home county has been equally vehement that they want to keep their power. This matter has come up many times as I've been legislated here where essentially some of the Eastern Oregon counties have said that they want their district attorneys to set the standards for law enforcement in their county. And in many states, the Attorney General, maybe California, I don't know, many states, the Attorney General is supervisor of the district attorney. And they essentially work for him in criminal law enforcement. In this state, every time that matter faintly suggested, they start coming over from across the path, and it's the last of it's heard of. I think, respect the way that we're trying to stand. I think that in terms of the way this act will have to work in terms of Oregon tradition, that we have to continue this joint ability to proceed. However, there are limitations because this attorney must make full report to the Attorney General, file copies of things to the Attorney General. So I think it will work out as a practical matter without changing the 111 years of records of proceedings.
Well, I have yet to be convinced that you can go to a part-time attorney to effectively enforce the statute.
Well, and I'll clarify in my mind now. Basically, the way the law is written, the way we've suggested it, either one can take all the action. In other words, the Attorney General can still do everything you're saying he's doing, even though the local district attorney also has the option of carrying the ball out. So why? What's the objection?
Your deterrent effect of the thing is going to be better if you have
just one guy. In other words, you can't pass the buck as much. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's partly it, and also you're going to get more national exposure from more aggressive Attorney General enforcement. With local county enforcement. And this is the type of thing which is going to discourage justice practitioners from coming to the state.
So if we've got a gung-ho Attorney General, can he go ahead and do anything that he wanted to do?
If he had the funding, if he had the staff, if he had the equipment, that's one of the reasons we like the Attorney General's bill. They create the division, they have a separate appropriations bill. No, I think that their section is the same as this one, and you'll notice in our suggested amendments 1088, we make the same suggestion that we make here. It's the parallel provision between guidance. many of our amendments, in fact, where the provisions are the same, we're suggesting consistent language between the two bills.
What really bothers me about this is that he directs a district attorney to act as long as you've got a murder and a false advertising all the time, when you put in the murder. That has to be, well, that's the way they feel, and I know that from working in the district attorney's office, that they're very well intended. They do have a very heavy burden. The official position of the district attorney's office was that they were in favor. At that time, the only bill they were aware of was House Bill 1088. They were in favor of House Bill 1088, with the substitution of the word prosecuting attorney for, substitution of the word district attorney for prosecuting attorney. They liked all the substantive provisions, and that was a divided vote. I think there is, particularly from your major counties, urban counties, there's a feeling that the attorney general has the right and should participate in this program.
In other words, the present law, I wrote in 1965, the district attorney in court.
Only,
that's the way it's been since 65. This bill gives the attorney general the authority to enforce, in addition to district attorney in court. My feeling is that's as far as we're going to be able to go without taking away from the district attorney's right to be on our own.
Both can act under that. Under this bill, both can act. And I think there's going to be particularly important in terms of what financing is available. What do we want this to come to do? But we're just going to be reporting to the AG, so I think we will be important.
I'd buy that.
As a practical matter, if I was the attorney general, I would call up the district attorney of that county and the district bill passed and said, here's such and such going on. Who can take them on? You and me. I've got a big staff and I can take them on with you. You go to it, and I think in many cases, if the DA in smaller counties and say, I'm going to be prosecuting first degree murder charge, bless you, come on in. In the case of some of the larger counties where they're set up for it, they may say, no, we can handle it. We appreciate the tip. Come there.
I would
think we'd jeopardize the bill if we wiped the district attorney out.
No, I'm happy. I
don't want to eat on. I don't think that I'm proposing to wipe the district attorney out.
Elected officials give assistance to another elected official.
Well, and another concern in relation to prior approval language, it seems to me that you just hit the nail on the head. You're talking about elected officials imposing how many counties are between here and Portland. And don't we get the Portland newspapers here? And we're putting in an advertising practice that's done. That could EPA bring the action, or prior approval, Attorney General to bring the action in force violation in 9, 10, 12 counties?
Yeah, the answer is they could, but they've had that right for the past 5 years, and our problem has not been too much enforcement, but too little. Anyway, my suggestion is go on. I don't think there's just two more things. First of all, Dave and I both suggest that a criminal penalty be taken out. This is the sales below cost in the day. Neither Dave nor I believe that criminal penalty is an appropriate method for enforcing the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. That's been my philosophy over the years it goes on before I went to places.
I'm sorry, there's one other provision which has never been used, and that's the little Pat and Robinson Act, which is a discrimination between suppliers, which is 646.010 to 080, and there has been no activity in that by any district attorney that I'm aware of, and that would be included here.
Well, it's always been my thought that we run the civil thing, in fact, in 1967, by inadvertent, Gracie Peck put through an amendment to add a provision for blind people and had a criminal penalty in there inadvertently became law, so I could go through later in that same session to appeal the criminal penalty that became decision. The only final one we have, Madam Chairman, is Dave has written some language back under the class action thing, which we can solve.
Remember,
one, two, three, four, five, six, and seven.
So I think you're pointing to renumbering two, three, and four to one, two, and three.
Oh.
So I'd go the old three, four, and eight.
Two, three, and four. One, two, and eight. And then the final thing is they've written some language which we think gets at the problem of the admissions made at the preliminary hearing. And this would go at the end of number C on the big insert. Additional language. Admissions made by the defendant at the preliminary hearing provided under subsection C of this section are for the purposes of the hearing only and may not be used at the time of trial of the issue. Yep, is that a D or is that a different
language? It could be made a D.
Anyway, this, what you have here is a product from long hard work since you last, met, and the chairman wants a motion on the chair to move the number.
Well, go ahead. I think we come back to only one standard difference between the two, and apparently it's in this class action thing, and I don't know that I know all there is to know. I know very little about it, except what I've heard of the discussion on this thing. First thing, a political question. Is this going to jeopardize the passage of what might otherwise be an excellent bill?
In my opinion, no.
The other thing, is the class action provisions, as they've been modified in the discussion today, is this, would you characterize this as being substantially more restrictive than what's been passed in other states and other areas, or is it about the same, or where does it lie in the whole class action picture?
I would say roughly parallel and shorter, I think, in California. Is that accurate?
I would say it was slightly more, slightly more favorable to the plaintiffs in California and probably as parallel or a little stronger than Massachusetts, and I think North Carolina is probably more liberal than we are. So we can't be labeled anywhere, really. At least I don't think that we're, I think at least that we're more in the middle than anything else.
Are there just three states that have this now?
There are so many before legislatures at this time, that this proposal
is being considered everywhere.
Well, I recognize this. I've read the national legislation, but I want to fit it in with what has been done already. You always feel much safer, at least I do, if someone else has tried this thing out and found that, well, it didn't provide all the problems that have been indicated for class action.
The reason why I think this is important, and why from the FCC and all these other model acts, who themselves give them good thought, is that there's only one attorney general, only a limited number of district attorneys who have time to do this, and you can't expect government to do everything. U.S., some of these witnesses with legal aid brought the other day, essentially what would this bill do to improve your situation? Part of the answer is better definitions, but actually the existing definitions of cruder would probably incorporate fairly gross fraud. But this allows private people to protect themselves without having government do all the protection for them. Now, even though you provide for a $200 minimum penalty for the individual citizen, there are not many individuals
the word patron who are going to take the trouble to hire a lawyer to collect that $200. So that's a remedy that has some value. People may go on a small claims court, occasionally there will be somebody who says, my God, it's a matter of principle. But even the $200 really isn't going to convince them to really go after them. On the other hand, if you can get a situation where there are a number of frauds, we're postulating frauds, you know, and if they're not frauds, they're defendants. Assuming frauds, if you can put them together in this class case, with all the procedural safeguards that we have ready to prevent abuse, then you've got a real way of getting the restitution of people who are taken. And that's why not only is this in all the state bills, but either the first or second priority of the Consumer Federation of America on a national level, the bill sponsored by Senator Magnus in Washington, which essentially provides a class action in the federal court, on the theory that the most important thing in the whole area is the remedy. I'm going to make my little pitch for why I think it's important.
Okay, we have more time.
He's on my committee on environment. I went and asked him the same question. He said that I'm an alternate member, which means that I want to focus attention on the work of these three new committees, environmental affairs, consumer affairs, and criminal law and procedure, but I'm not a alternate.
What really includes this, but this is what you have in front of you.
Plus the one that they're doing.
And plus the one that they're doing this. This is an exact copy of this, plus there's one additional one that's in there that for some reason is not taken what you just got. But limiting the attorney to an individual.
May I ask a very question? Basically, you agreed on most of the amendments, either agreed or my objections would be painfully nullified to the point where I'm not going to go through them again on these other amendments. Some of them, you answered my objections indirectly, and in other cases directly, and as I, you know, we sort of went through most of the same points we went through last week, and in all the cases, the situation is more balanced. Our primary objection now is.
Madam Chairman, I would move the amendment on the class action section.
The motion is to eliminate the role of working on the legal and working in class action and class action.
I think it's a fair way to proceed with class action, which will allow the consumer to use it to provide them and go safeguard the different concerns with them. Well, just a few. I mean, the motion I am making consists of the changes that are pasted into the book, which we've gone over item by item, plus the correctional renumbering, and plus the single edition, which is the only edition not in this. So therefore, what we're adopting is the material we have gone over, if we adopt it. Anything else we have not gone over would not be included in the motion.
It's fine. You know, you have a couple of three pages here. You don't know exactly what you're doing.
Well, we've taken these copies of these and cut them and pasted. It's the same thing, cut and pasted in.
Thank you very much.